What is the impact of eating a high protein diet on your body composition? And what about on your kidneys, your bones, your overall health? Do you know the benefits of eating higher protein? And what about as you age, do you need to be adjusting your protein intake? If any of these questions are in your mind or you're curious about, you're in the right place for today's episode of the Inside Sports Nutrition Podcast, your source for all things sports nutrition related. Welcome. This show is hosted by myself, Dina Griffin, and my co-host, Bob Sebahar. We are both registered dietitians and board certified specialists in sports dietetics with combined professional experience exceeding 40 years. We are here to translate nutrition and sports science research to real life and give you some awesome interviews with a variety of experts so that you can enhance your knowledge to optimize your fitness, your health, your athletic performance. On today's episode, we are delighted to have with us Dr. Jose Antonio, who is the co-founder of the International Society for Sports Nutrition, also known as the ISSN. He is a well-known researcher with over 100 peer-reviewed publications. He's a professor at Nova Southeastern University in Florida, a stand-up paddler, and an all-around great guy. We had so much fun talking with him. And we get to hear more about how he started the ISSN. We get to chat about some of his work in researching supplements and his pioneering research in protein overfeeding studies. They fed over four times what the recommended dietary allowance is. So we get to hear some of the findings and implications for real life athletes. Before we get to the show, wanted to mention that I've got a couple new programs starting here in the early 2024, a new menopause support program, and also a protein course that's open for anyone. Basically, if you're health conscious or confused about protein, this is an in-depth look at all of the aspects related to protein, and it's a self-study course. So head over to nutritionmechanic.com, get on the newsletter to be notified of how you can access these courses as they open. All right, let's get to episode 110, our conversation with Dr. Jose Antonio. All right, we are super excited today to have you on our podcast, Dr. Jose Antonio. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm looking forward to a fun little conversation here. So I want you to fire away.
Excellent. Well, we know at the time that we're recording this, which is mid-morning Colorado time, it's a couple hours ahead of your time being in Florida. So just curious, starting us off, how did you begin your day today?
Well, as many of my friends know, I'm a big fan of coffee. In fact, as you guys know, coffee is probably one of the more healthier beverages you can consume. And yep. So when I get up, I head right to the coffee maker. I hit the on button, wait for it to drip. It takes like 5 minutes. Then I get my two or three cups in the morning. And that, you know, that's how I start my day. It's, you know, it's funny. I'm like, how long have I been doing that? Probably since grad school, back when either Ronald Reagan and Bush one were president. So that's when I was in grad school. And then I did my postdoc when Bill Clinton was president. So okay. Hopefully your listeners will know when that is. Or maybe, I better Google, when was Clinton president? When was Bush one president?
Yeah, just a few years ago.
Right, exactly.
That is a little bit of a history lesson. Some of our listeners would be like, oh, yeah, like you bring them back a little bit now.
Yeah, exactly. I like giving a sort of inserting history lessons into what I talk about, because, you know, when we get into the whole protein issue, there's an interesting history to how that sort of evolved within sports science and even within the, I guess, even within the fitness culture. So there's a lot of really interesting things.
Well, let's push the pause button on it because I want to hear that, but I want to get through this first question because I want our listeners to understand, like, you are a researcher and academic, but you've done so many things outside of that, what I call like real life practice also. And, you know, we love, and I don't even know, you're going to have to tell me in president speak. Well, tell us a little bit about the ISSN, right? International Society for Sport Nutrition. I believe when you, because you were one of the driving forces of creating that wonderful organization that really brought a lot of researchers, but also kind of the real life, the people in the field, if you will, together. And I feel like it really put a stamp on the sport nutrition field in terms of where we're going and what we can do at sport nutrition. So just give us a little background, like where did that come from? How did that evolve? What's the why?
Well, it's an interesting question because I'll be quite honest, I not only had no intention of starting an academic nonprofit, I really didn't want to. and part of that was there's a lot of work involved. It's like you're basically starting a company. It's like, wow, do I have time to start a company? Do we have time? You know, my friend Doug Kalman, it was really him and I that sort of spearheaded it. It's like, wow, okay, well, do either one of us know how to do this? Well, no, neither one of us does. Okay, but we're going to do it anyways. But that's sort of fast forwarding. Let's go back a little. When I was in doing my master's degree, I worked with a guy named Peter Lemon. This was at Penn State University. And Pete Lemon was one of the first researchers to talk about increased protein needs, particularly for endurance athletes, because that's sort of where he focuses research in. And this, remember, this is the mid 80s. And most people outside of this tiny, tiny group of exercise physiologists thought, I don't know about that. Early in my academic career as a student, I attended primarily the American College of Sports Medicine conferences and later on the National Strength and Conditioning Association. Attending ACSM was eye-opening for several reasons. One, they were very anti, and I want to say anti-sports nutrition, but very anti-sports supplements, which I was like, wow, that's really strange. I mean, the only way to, you know, to study this stuff is to do research, but they seem to not be a fan of even doing research in this area. So I'm like, okay, that kind of stuck in my head. Doug Kalman, this is late 90s. He organized, and you guys are aware of this, he organized a conference. It was a SCAN conference, which, you know, is a subgroup of the, then it was the American Dietetic Association. Now it's the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, but he organized a SCAN meeting that focused on sports nutrition. I'm like, wow, this is really cool. Because there really wasn't anything like that. So we had this conference. At the time, this was interesting. I wasn't working in academics at the time. I was working for a company in South Florida called Rexall Sundown, which was owned, which was part of a huge conglomerate. It was Rexall Sundown, GNC, Metrics, Worldwide Sport Nutrition. It was owned by a giant giant company based in Holland called Royal Numico. They owned it all. At the time, it was the largest supplement company in the world. So I was able to bring Metrics dollars to SCAN. And so Metrics sponsored the dinner, right? They sponsored our dinner. And you guys are well aware of Susan Kleiner. She was at the dinner. In fact, she was one of the speakers at the time. And we're sitting at this large table and she's sitting across from me. And she's like, hey, Joey. And that's my nickname, Joey.
Yeah.
Hey, we should start our own organization. And I'm thinking, that sounds like a lot of work. Not really. I don't really want to do that. But it was kind of funny because we all thought, okay, well, that maybe makes sense. Maybe it doesn't. But this is what the kicker was. So what prompted us to think more deeply about it? I actually tried to join SCAN.
Oh.
I tried. And they said, and why do we join organizations? We join them to network. Hey, not many people do sports and nutrition. You guys seem to be interested in it. I'll join, pay the dues, network, you know, yada, yada, yada. They said no. They said no because I'm not a dietitian.
Oh my gosh.
I said, but I just gave a talk at SCAN. I was invited by SCAN, but you don't want me to join SCAN. And they're like, well, you got to be a dietitian. And I said, but half the people that gave a talk weren't dietitians.
Yeah.
They're like, yeah, but you got to be a dietitian. I said, okay, well, I find that kind of thinking quite parochial. And I thought, okay, well, that's really strange. So, and that's just one of many stories. Before I get to that, this is a good one. Before we had our official meeting about starting ISSN, Jeff Stout, who's at University of Central Florida now, he runs the graduate program there in exercise science. They graduate a lot of really great PhD students. We gave a talk at ACSM. This was, I want to say it's 1999 or 2000 or somewhere in that area. And for people who attended that talk, it was they called it a colloquium, but it was like a couple hours of, I talked about supplements. Dr. Stout talked about the history of it. And at the end of the talk, first of all, before the talk, I told Jeff Stout, I'm like, man, this is probably the most boring PowerPoint I've ever put together. It's just boring. But we purposely made it boring because we knew ACSM was quite anti-supplements. I'm like, you know what? Let's make it really vanilla. Yeah. No one will get mad. But when we finished the talk, people got mad. It was just the craziest thing. I'd say,
oh my gosh,
half the audience, it was a lot of people. There's like 300 in there. I'd say half the audience despised us. The other half, they were surprisingly, they loved us. So it was this weird, like almost a division. I remember one of the first people who come up to ask a question. It wasn't even a question. It was a criticism. It was pretty vile, actually. He came up to the mic and he basically said, and I'll paraphrase it. He goes, I can't believe ACSM allowed you to give a talk on this stuff. This stuff is fake. It's bullshit. Blah, 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 blah.
Oh, my gosh. Oh,
wow. But he said it. He was really pissed off. I was like, wow, he's kind of mad. And there were a few mad people there, but there was an interesting sort of back and forth within the audience, right? And there was a gentleman who you could just by looking at his physique, he was a bodybuilder. And I knew who he was because he owned a store, a supplement store. And he stood up and criticized a scientist who was criticizing us. So I'm like, oh, my God, he's criticizing him. And this is what he said. And he wasn't very nice either. So this bodybuilder says to the scientist, he's like, I bet you don't even consume creatine based on his physique. And I was like, oh, my God.
Here we go.
Here we go. It's like, oh, my God, this is going to be WWE. So so the bodybuilder and the scientist, they go into the middle of the auditorium. You know where the microphone is?
Yeah.
They're near the microphone and they are nose to nose. You know how like fighters will get nose to nose?
Yeah.
And I look at Jeff Stout. I'm like, oh, my God. I think there's going to be a fight. This is crazy. So what happened was, I'm sure you're familiar with Dr. Rick Kreider. He's at Texas A&M now. He was at the very back of the auditorium, and he stood up and he just screamed. He screamed. He says, basically in a very loud voice, he says, "Everybody, just shut up and let these guys answer these questions." And everyone just shut up because, you know, everyone knows Dr. Kreider. Yeah. So everyone shut up. They still ask questions. A lot of people still did not like us. So I was like, oh, okay, well, people at ACSM, at least half of them don't seem to like this stuff. But it got worse. It got worse. Later on, Jeff Stout and I attended a cocktail party. And we're young scientists. We basically just got our degrees. We're trying to figure out what the hell we're doing with our lives. And the president of ACSM walks up to us and says, and I couldn't believe it when she said this. I was shocked. And Jeff was shocked because he's like, what, did she just say what I think she just said? She looked us straight in the eye and she said, if you want to have a career, don't do any research in supplements.
What?
Oh, wow.
Yes. And my brain, it was one of those things where, wait, did I hear that?
Yeah.
And Jeff looked at me like, did we hear the same thing? And she made it clear that, and I'm thinking either that's sort of weird advice or kind of a weird threat or a combination of both. But here's the kicker. She was someone who took money from Gatorade, which I have no problem with Gatorade, but right. If you're going to take private money to do research on Gatorade, which by the way is a supplement, then you should be encouraging other young investigators to want to do studies that are funded by, you know, private supplement companies. So that really pissed me off. So all these things are happening. We end up going to, oddly enough, next year at an ACSM, American College of Sports Medicine conference. We had a dinner. It was myself, Doug Kalman, Rick Kreider, Susan Kleiner and Anthony Almada. And basically we had a dinner and we said, should we do this? And it was basically from a business side, it was Doug and I doing, decided to do it. And we're like, yeah, let's do it. So basically then Doug and I decided, okay, we'll do it. We don't know what the hell we're doing, but we're going to figure it out. I mean, it's like running a, it's like you're building a company, even though you don't know how to build a company. But so what we do, we ask people about it. And this was our goal. Our goal was really simple. Our goal was to introduce people in industry to people in science so that the industry would appreciate that if you want to launch a product, at least have it supported by some data. Unless you want to go back to the 70s where Joe Weider and his products, they would launch stuff, they'd make stuff up. It's all marketing and puffery and all that BS. I mean, why don't we instill some science in it? And that's really, in the simplest terms, that's really the goal of ISSN is to promote science as it applies to sports nutrition and sports supplements. And, you know, it's been 20 years. Have we done a good job? I think we have. And this is the metric I would use. Before the year 2000, you would be hard pressed to find a course in sports nutrition or one in sports supplements. It would be rare. In the year 2023, every major college has a course in sports nutrition. In fact, gotcha. What's weird, my university, it's a small private university. We have two courses in sports nutrition from two different departments. We have two more courses in human nutrition. And then I teach a course on supplements. So we have like five, which is like, wow, we went from nothing to like five, which I'm like, this is crazy. But here's the thing. Sports nutrition is a fun category. That's why we're in it, because it's fun. People want to talk about it. People who know nothing about science will ask me about sports nutrition. They have no idea how the science is done, but they're like, hey, in fact, I was at a cycling race. My wife, she's a national class cyclist this weekend. And once this guy found out what I did, he's like, hey, can I ask you some questions? You know, so they asked me about beetroot juice and creatine and beta-alanine. I'm like, he's like, I don't know what the stuff does, but maybe it helps me. I'm like, well, it could. So that's sort of the short story of how we started ISSN. It was, I hate to say, it was purely accidental. In fact, if ACSM and SCAN was more open to that there is a legitimate field of inquiry here, we would not have done this. It's just like, well, here's the thing, and you guys give me your thoughts on this. There are so many people in academia, whether it's clinical nutrition or sports nutrition or just academia in general, who are really close-minded, like really close. And it should shock me, but then I guess it doesn't, because that's human nature. People want to, you know, sort of cling to their little territories, and it's just odd. I still don't get. And in fact, ACSM, I want to go back to ACSM because this is interesting. I'm not, like, most of my training now is aerobic training because I do mostly stand-up paddling races. Mm-hmm. Back in the 80s, if you went to an ACSM conference, there were very, very, very anti-resistance training. It was really weird. Yeah. And it's not like I was just weight training guy. It was like, I'm sitting here. Everyone makes fun of people who lift weights. I'm like, that's just not right. That's just not right. Yeah. And that's why the NSCA started, because there were a group of people who said, you know what? Resistance training actually is very important for a wide variety of reasons, whether it's for performance, whether it's for rehabilitation, whether it's, hey, you just want to prevent, you know, osteopenia or sarcopenia. So within scientific organizations, you will find these weird ideologies that aren't science-based, that they're more emotion-based. And I tell people that hopefully ISSN will never go down that path where it's ideology. It's, you know, I tell people, hey, wherever the data falls, that's where the conclusion follows. It's like, those of us who are involved in ISSN, we don't fight battles based on, hey, I think this idea is great, so I'm going to make sure I support this idea and ignore all the other stuff. It's, hey, that's what the data shows. It is what it is, you know, even though I kind of hate that phrase, it is what it is. But anyway, for that long-winded answer, but there's all these things that went on back then. It's like, I sometimes replay it and I wonder, God, it would have turned out so much different if one, SCAN let me join.
Yeah.
If SCAN let me join, probably none of this would have happened.
Well, we're thankful that you had, the impetus and will to start this, or the fodder to start it. And it reminds me of stories Bob and I have told too, like when we were in our graduate programs or bachelor, like making a career out of sports nutrition was not a thing. It was not encouraged or supported. I mean, there wasn't the curriculum And it was like poo-pooed, right? And so thank gosh for these newer waves of thinking and opening doors and like moving away from some of the older school boxes that we were all put in.
I was just going to say,
I mean, my interaction with ISSN and you struck so many chords, Joey, when you were explaining that, because it was like 99, I finished my second graduate degree. And that's when I was, you know, 2000, sorry. And that's when I was going through my dietetic internship. And like Dina said, like my preceptor was like, hey, what do you want to do with your life? I'm like, it's sport nutrition or die, you know, and she's laughing at me and that whole thing. And, you know, in when you're young, like you were saying, you know, and you want to make a difference, you want to make an impact, and people are saying no, or people are saying, don't talk about supplements to my group or my athletes or whatever. And you're like, what? Right. That, so I sure. And that's like the great impact that the ISSN has had on me, because I think it allowed us early on to have those conversations, and very logical and very intelligent conversations, rather than pointing the fingers. Cause there's a lot of finger pointing, like your story mentioned. I mean, a lot of finger pointing back in the days. And I don't think there's as much finger pointing. I do still think there's a lot of old school sport nutrition in there still, and people who are anti-supplement discussions and just everything, and even anti-protein, what I mean? It's like carbon fat these days, although protein is finally getting another, you know, reborn light, which is nice, which we'll hit on here. But I just want to say, like, I appreciate what you and Doug did, and thank goodness that, ACSM rubbed you the wrong way and scanned in, let you in. Otherwise, we probably wouldn't be here talking, right? It probably wouldn't have influenced your career like it did.
Yeah, it's funny how things that you don't expect to sort of influence which way you head, career-wise, end up influencing you. You know,
totally. People think,
you go to school, get a degree. Oh, I like this. And that's not how it turned out. In fact, briefly, when I was at the University of Delaware, I was only there for a semester. I got a small grant to do a study on, I forget the supplement. This was like the year 2000, and went back and forth with the IRB. Eventually I said, screw it. I don't want to do this study, because the IRB was giving me so much crap. In fact, one of their standard was, how do you know people won't die from this? I'm like, die? Death is now the standard. Anyways, I got an, I don't know if it was an email or voicemail. Was email popular in 2000? I think it was still, right?
I would say popular, but it was coming.
Voicemail or email? They basically said, we don't want you doing research on supplements. Oh. It's University of Delaware. I was like, wow, this is really trying to piss me off, these people. It's funny. The more I think about it, I'm like, wait, I have another story. This is another story. Popping up in my head. But
My gosh.
You know, if you're a resilient person, you're like, okay, that's not a smart idea. I'll just move on and figure it out, you know. So
yeah. So then thank you for sharing the overview of the trajectory there. That is so fascinating to hear. And I've heard that story a few times, but I always pick up something new perspective, even from the historical angle. Dr. Antonio, I mean, you are known for your research areas in supplementation and protein. And so we thought, with the time of the season we're recording this, you know, a lot of individuals and athletes think about weight loss, body composition, as they start kind of end their season and think about next year. And so we wondered if you could start us off. We want to talk about protein as it relates to body composition change and weight loss, fat loss. Could you start us off maybe highlighting some of the areas you have seen in your research and with your colleagues in terms of protein intake, that the role of that macronutrient when we are pursuing, we could call it fat loss or...
I have, you know, it's funny. This is also what I call an accidental area of research. This is what prompted me. And we're talking, okay, let's go back to 2012. I'm at Nova Southeastern University. And I remember a student of mine, and you see this with bodybuilders all the time. He'd always have a jug of water. He'd bring it into class. He'd always eat during class. And I didn't care. I'm like, you'd eat during class. I don't care if you want to eat. And he'd drink his jug of water. And I'm like, and I always gave him a hard time because he always sat out front and he thought he knew more than he did. So I'd always give him a hard time. And one day I said, you know, how much do you eat and how much protein do you eat? And one thing I love about bodybuilders is they know exactly what they eat. Exactly. So he sort of did, you know, he's thinking in his head. He's like, oh, I get about 300 grams a day. And I'm like, he's a pretty big guy. I'm like, wow, you're like around 3 grams per kilo. Huh? That's a lot more than most people I know. And so I started thinking, what if I did a study where we just made sure trained people. Now, the caveat I always tell people when I talk about protein research is I've only done this in trained people. I don't do studies in sedentary people. So what if we got trained people and we just had them consume 2 grams of protein per pound body weight, which is a lot of protein. That's 4.4 grams per kilo. Mm-hmm. Now, before I embarked on the study, sort of have these conversations in my own head. And I'm thinking, why am I doing this? To show that it won't cause harm? Because that really was the underlying thing. It shouldn't cause harm. I'm like, I feel like I'm wasting my time showing that protein doesn't cause harm. But then the other side of me said, but all these people say it causes harm.
Yeah.
Like, okay, well, we better do the study. So we did the 4.4 grams per kilo. It was just simple. Eat a lot of protein. We'll body comp you. And I think we'll event. I think it was a second study, but we won't do any blood markers yet. I just want to see what happens. It was one of those. It was like, oh, what'll happen? Well, in the aggregate, nothing happened. It was like they ate a lot of protein. In the aggregate, body weight doesn't change, fat mass doesn't change, percent fat doesn't change, and that might have been the weirdest outcome of all. I was like, wait, so if you just eat, and we're talking about powder, this wasn't food.
Yeah.
A ton of protein powder a day for 8 weeks. Nothing happens. Now, I do remember a lot of the subjects, and you can relate to this if you work with people who eat a lot of protein. They complained about being hot all day. They were sweaty. And I remember one guy, I hate to say it, but I'm like, when he came for post-testing, I'm like, man, you kind of smell and you're always sweaty. What is up? He's like, yeah, protein, bro. He's like, protein, bro. It's like, and in fact, he volunteered for every study I did because he's like, I don't have to buy protein anymore. You give me all this protein. But here's the caveat. A lot of people quit. I'd say 20 to 25% of subjects quit after about 2 or 3 weeks. A lot of them said, you know what? I just can't do this. First of all, food's no longer fun. I'm never hungry because, as you know, protein will kill your appetite. And I'm like, damn, we need to redo this. One, lower the dose a little. And the next time it's 3.4 grams per kilo. But also, we changed the program so everyone was on a bodybuilding program, and we made sure to do some blood chemistry markers. So I'm like, okay, we repeated it, lowered the dose, 3.4 grams per kilo. It's still high. That's still high. Another 8-week study, but we put them on a bodybuilding program. And this is probably the most interesting of all the studies in terms of body comp. We found that at a level about 2.2 grams per kilo, which is 1 gram per pound, they gained an equal amount of lean body mass. However, the group that was at 3.4 grams per kilo actually lost more fat mass. So I'm thinking, okay, if the goal is just mass, lean mass, you could probably stop at a gram per pound. But is there any harm? Is any harm going higher than that? And to me, the short answer is no. In fact, if you go up to 3 grams per kilo, you might actually lose fat mass. And then when we did the blood chemistry markers, there was no change in kidney function, liver function, all that fun stuff. So it was safe. Now, the body comp stuff is interesting to a lot of people because when it's been repeated only a few times in trained people, I think Bill Campbell at USF repeated it, found the same thing. If you jack protein, protein by itself doesn't seem to promote gains in fat mass. If anything, it might promote the loss of fat mass. But the question of safety kept coming up. It's like, okay, well, people, you know, what if you do this high protein diet for a year? And I'm like, okay, well, I'll see who will volunteer for that. And it was all guys, a bunch of bodybuilders are like, you know what? Sure, I'll do it for a year. I mean, they were already high, but I wanted them to be closer to 3 grams per kilo. So we did it for a year, looked at blood markers, nothing changes. And it's funny, social media is crazy. Back then it's like, well, okay, well, that's a year. What if they did it for 2 years? I'm like, oh my God, they keep changing the goalposts.
I know. So
it's like, you know, okay, well, you know, I'll get the most dedicated of these guys and we're going to follow them up for 2 years. Averaging roughly 3.3 to 3.5 grams per kilo of protein. Blood lipids, no change. Kidney function, no change. liver function, no change. Blood glucose, no change. I'm like, these guys are fine. They're eating super high protein diets for up to 2 years. Now, when people ask me about that, they're like, well, what if my aunt or uncle did that? You know, would that be safe? And this is what I say. I said, for one, they wouldn't. That's one. For two, they don't train the way these people train. Mm-hmm. These people train hard. Yes. And in fact, one of the critiques was, why are you only studying male bodybuilders? So I'm like, okay, let me study women. So we got highly trained women. Some were world-class runners, world-class cyclists, world-class surfer. So these are women who train hard. So I'm like, why don't we put you on a high protein diet, again, through powder. Let's look at bone mineral density, because that's one of the criticisms I heard. In fact, when I was at Scan, I heard that from a dietitian. I'm like,
yep.
Protein, what makes your bones weaker? Leaches calcium? I'm like, I don't believe you. I just don't believe you. But anyways, so we did the DEXA baseline, 6 months, 1 year, consuming high protein diet. There's no change in whole body bone mineral density. We also did a lumbar spine scan. No change in lumbar spine over a year. So again, what's the caveat? And this is the part I think people have a hard time understanding. These are people who train hard. Most people in the world, well, let's put it this way. In the United States, most people are overweight or obese. Yeah. So 70% of our population can't even relate to what these people do on a daily basis. As you guys well know, when you train, and I tell physician groups this all the time, when you're dealing with trained people versus untrained people, you're almost dealing with a different species of human. Trained people are not the people you see walking into your clinic or your office, you know, as a patient. They're not trained. They're not the same kind of people. So when these people are like, well, God, how do these women, they consume all this protein and they seem all healthy. I'm like, have you seen them train? Mm-hmm. So that's always the caveat. It's like, no one's going to eat this much protein unless you're someone who trains hard, because the average person who's sedentary, overweight, probably diabetic, they're eating junk. Let's face it. We know it. They're eating junk. But within the context of people who train and who are exercising, whether they're men or women, one, high protein diets are safe. Two, they probably confer a pretty good body composition effect independent of adding exercise, because in those initial studies, we didn't really change energy output. It was just they ate more protein. So it's kind of interesting that protein out of the three macronutrients, think about this, carbs, fat, protein. You can go online, and these are researchers. These are not like people who don't understand the literature. There are people, in fact, many people who will put a hard limit on protein intake. It's like, what? Once you hit 1.6 grams per kilo, that's it, you're done. And I'm thinking, okay, but if you hit 1.6 grams per kilo, there's only two things left to eat, carbs and fat. Exactly. Now, do you really need that much carbs and fat? I would guess for most people, no. What if you're an endurance athlete? And you'll appreciate this, Bob. Mm-hmm. Okay, what if you are an endurance athlete? Okay, you guys are familiar with the recommendations for endurance athlete, particularly as it applies to carbs. I think Louise Burke has, I believe it's Burke. She's published some stuff showing you could go up to 8 to 10 grams per kilo of carbs for endurance athletes. I work with endurance athletes. I don't know anyone who does that. I don't know anybody who does that. My wife, she's a master's class champion USA cycling. She eats 3 grams per kilo. Yeah. I mean, I've seen her diet. But get this, her protein is 3 grams per kilo. Mm-hmm. Oh. So what she's doing as a national class endurance athlete doesn't even follow the recommendations of most people. They follow my recommendations. That's what I tell her. So yeah. These are the Antonio recommendations. This is what they recommend. Let's do what I tell you. Yeah. I don't even remember what the initial question was, Dean.
Well, Joey, you put this on the map, right? Yeah. You really, at least for me, right? And when totally. I say me, I'm really talking about sport dietitians of my era, of all of our era, right? Not the new ones, because the new ones, I think they're starting to get this in university, but not as much still. But this is a couple things. One, I love that you brought up the trained, because in my mind too, it's not just about physical fitness. I mean, we know that's a part of it, but it's also the mindset, because as we work with athletes who are trained versus maybe less trained, it's the mindset of a trained athlete who will say, you want me to eat 3 grams of protein per kg for 2 years? Okay, no problem. Whereas I believe the less trained or untrained mindset wise, they're like, no, that's too hard. I can't do it. Right. So one thing I want our listeners to really pull out is it is not just all physical. It is also mindset. The second thing I want to point out, because I remember when you were doing this research and I loved it, like I used it in all my talks back then. I was like, oh my God, now we finally have research on protein. Thank God. Because my big thing is optimizing blood sugar, protein first. It always has been, right? But I got a lot of pushback, as you did. When your research started to come out, a lot of the naysayers that were coming to me regarding my education to them based on your research was like, oh, like you mentioned, oh, male bodybuilders, but then you did the female study. And then the naysayers were like, oh, but it's just protein powder. It's not, here's the dietitians, right? Oh, but it's not real food. That's not real life. What would you say to those people who are like, oh, you just fed protein powder and that's not realistic and it's not the food first model, which we know is not too efficacious anymore. Like, did you get some pushback with that?
Within the exercise science circles, I actually did not. It was usually, it's funny, it was usually dietitians.
Yes.
But here's the thing. A lot of the younger dietitians now actually don't think like that anymore. Yeah. At least the ones who attend ISSN. In fact, a lot of them are protein centric. They're protein first. Yeah. Let's introduce carbs and fat later. Now, I've never been okay. It's funny. I have one of my graduate students, Cassie Evans. She's a master's. She has an RD, but she's doing her PhD. Mm-hmm. And I asked her, why do they teach this food first stuff as it applies? Let's talk about just athletes. I forget sedentary people.
Yep.
This whole food first, you know, sort of at the exclusion of supplementation. And my philosophy has always been, what's your goal? Okay, let's say your goal is either to bench press, you know, 50 pounds more or to run a 5K, you know, 1 minute faster, which is a lot. What's the goal? Well, if that's the goal, well, supplements and foods are all the same category. They're things you consume. There's not a hierarchy of, you know, make sure, because how many people actually have the best diet? Make sure your diet's perfect. Oh, and then let's supplement. How about this? Just do as good as you can with your diet, add some supplements and see how you do. Because even, you know, I've known a lot of well-trained distance runners. I hate to say it, but sometimes their diet sucks, to be honest.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so in a way, supplements would actually help them more than the people who have their diet dialed in. And and you know what's interesting? Because, Bob, you worked with endurance athletes forever. And I'm always shocked how little they know about protein, which...
Oh, it's amazing. It's all carbs.
Yeah, I'm like, you know, your muscles have to recover, your immune system, it all has to recover. And that's not coming from carbs, per se. I mean, carbs are important. But, you know, protein's important. But obviously, they look at lay magazines. They're looking at social media. It's very carbohydrate-centric. But it's just interesting how at least there's a slow sort of evolution in clinical nutrition. At least clinical nutrition, you know, people who work out, showing that, okay, maybe protein shouldn't be sort of the last thing we think about. Maybe it should be the first thing we think about.
Mm-hmm. Could you comment maybe in the context of weight or body composition change, fat loss, on the distribution of protein throughout a day, so that some of the nuances and how that relates with, let's keep it with athletes, no matter if it's strength or endurance, but some of those nuances.
Yep. Okay. And you're talking about.
Yeah. If you could also here in the long list, like, and what about the women, you know, and then of course there's like peri and postmenopause coming in. So that's like another 3-hour thing. But if you could kind of highlight some of those nuances when we're thinking about protein across a day.
I think let's deal with protein distribution first. In general, whether you're a male or female athlete, protein distribution, it seems to follow a pattern of you want to eat a protein containing meal roughly every 3 to 4 hours. Now, that's ideal. Most people don't fit the ideal because they have a job, they might eat breakfast, then they have time for lunch, and they have dinner. So you're talking, okay, let's say 3 meals. You want protein distributed somewhat evenly. However, again, dealing with real humans, it tends to follow this pattern of breakfast, not as much. Lunch, there's more protein. Dinner is the most protein. Okay. It's not like we're dealing with professional athletes. These are just people who like to work out. Maybe they want to run faster. Maybe want to bike faster, swim faster, whatever. So when you're dealing with the realities of life and saying, well, ideally, you know, if you add protein every 3 hours, you know, it's like, well, geez, it's not like I'm a college student. I can't just eat every three hours. So you deal with the limitations of their life. Now, total protein intake still supersedes everything. So if you're getting, I'd say 1 gram per pound, that's my baseline. I tell people not to go below it. If you're getting 1 gram per pound, it's hard to do that in one meal. So I know you're at least splitting that into two or at least three meals. I mean, 1 gram per pound in two meals, I'm like, wow, you got to be eating a lot. So sort of by default, if you're hitting 1 gram per pound, you're getting three meals that probably at least are somewhat spaced semi-evenly. Now, I'll introduce a fourth meal, but people are like, well, that's not a meal. Well, let's call it a meal. You know, anytime you consume something, it's a meal. So let's say breakfast, lunch, dinner, and then a post-workout meal that contains protein. Now, depending on the sport, I usually recommend just make it pure protein. It could be anywhere from 20 to 40 grams. Most ready-to-drinks or RTDs are somewhere in that 20 to 40 gram amount. So just get whatever your favorite RTD is, drink it post-workout, and that's your fourth meal. Even though, oh, that's not a meal. Well, it's a meal. It just happens to be just a protein meal. There's not enough data now to suggest that there's a sex difference there. That's one. Two, in terms of perimenopause, I know my friend Abby Smith, she's delved into that research a little bit, but again, there's just not enough data to show that there's a physiologically significant difference in terms of how you should consume food vis-a-vis protein during those times, whether it's whether it's menopause or postmenopause, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the recommendations still stand based on your athletic goal. If you're if you don't have an athletic goal, then this conversation's moot. But if you have an athletic goal, then that should supersede everything else, whether you're male or female.
I was just going to ask, because I couldn't remember some of the study designs, like when you looked at energy intake or calories consumed, did you see, I can't remember if you tried to control that or like with those overfeeding studies, like you just couldn't eat controlled calories because appetite was suppressed. I just wonder your thoughts on those that do bump up intentionally their protein intake in pursuit of fat loss, body comp change. Do they just end up eating less overall or like all the mechanisms at play?
Yeah, that's a good question. For the second study we did where we compared the high protein, which was roughly 3.4 grams per kilo versus the control, this is the irony. The control group wasn't supposed to change their intake. And roughly, I remember they were roughly in the 1.8. I mean, you could argue that our control group was actually on high protein. You know, most people, if you ask, is 1.8 grams per kilo high? I'd say 99% of people say, yeah, that's high. I don't say it's high, but they say it's high. Mm-hmm. Well, the control group ended up eating more protein because they're like, well, I'm in a protein study. What's to stop me from eating more protein? So they actually went up a little over 2 grams per kilo. So really, 2 grams per kilo versus 3.4 grams per kilo. So you're really comparing really high to high. Not, versus really high to sort of the traditional 1.2 to 1.5 grams per kilo. I think what happens, there's a couple things that might happen. One, and you guys know this, when people do diet logs, it's like, oh, please don't lie. I know male bodybuilders are real good with it, but what about other athletes? They may not be as good. Are they eating less, but they're just not, their diet logs are not accurate? Okay, that can be true, but then it should be true in both groups. Like if they're both inaccurate, it should all be a wash. So it's not that. Mm-hmm. So what is protein doing? It's got to have something to do with, some sort of thermic effect. It has to be. Maybe your metabolism is slightly higher all the time just because you're eating all this protein. And maybe it displaces some carbs and fat, which is easier to store as fat when consumed in excess. I think what needs to happen is, and these studies aren't easy to do because it's hard to get people to do it. We need just, and I've had a student maybe suggest this. I'm like, I don't know if I would do this for a degree because you might shoot yourself trying to collect data, but just get people to just overconsume protein again and just to see what happens. But again, I would guess because I've been around, my sort of early career was being around bodybuilding. I've seen enough of it to realize that it's not a good way. Put this way, if your goal is, let's say I want to get fatter. That's my goal. eating protein isn't the way to do it. If I wanted to get fatter, I'd be like, give me a donut, give me bagel, cream cheese, give me processed carbs and throw some fat on it. I'll get fat. But if you said, okay, I want you to do a protein shake, here's some skinless chicken, I'm like, I'm not going to get fat doing that. You know, so people, a lot of people don't think that way because, you know, who actually wants to get fat? But think about it. I mean, I always say, do the experiment, thought experiment in your head. What if you wanted to get fat? Mm-hmm. Well, you're not eating, you're not drinking like, you know, protein shakes.
Right.
You should just follow the standard American diet if you want to do that, right?
Or that, yes. Yeah. Exactly.
No
Julie,
protein.
Let me ask you some, because I know our listeners, they may have, you know, we are very attuned to the numbers that you're throwing out, the grams per kg, gram per pound. But let me bring this back to the listeners in terms of real life, because your recommendation is a minimum of 1 gram of protein per pound, which is 2.2 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight. So right. I just did quick math on me, you know, and we were working on the protein distribution throughout the day. So what if I am that normal person, 8 to 5 or 8 to 6 or with a commute, whatever. And yeah, literally I fall into exactly what you said, low protein in morning, moderate at lunch and super high at dinner. Cause that's my schedule, right? I don't snack throughout the day. So my calculations based on your minimum amount of protein per day for my body weight, I need to consume 50 grams of protein per breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And I will tell you, because I've worked with these athletes before, that freaks them out, right? Because I don't know why people are so scared of eating protein. Well, I do know, but anyway, what do you say about like to that normal person who can't snack or doesn't snack? And you're like, wow, you got to dump 50 grams of protein in your body every single feeding or meal. What is your message to that person?
Yeah.
Should they change their nutrition plan? Like what would you recommend?
Well, what I would do is, okay, so if it's 150 grams, you divide it by 3, it's, you know, 50 grams a meal. I would say, how about this? Take away 40 of those grams. So that'd be 110. Now what's 110 divided by 3? I can't do the math very good. Something.
Right.
Okay. That's more manageable than most people. And then I'd say, hey, after you work out, get that 40 gram shake in. And then that seems more feasible for a lot of people, because a lot of people don't view the shake as a meal. So mentally they're like, well, hell, I could drink liquid. That's easy.
Yeah.
When you break it down into actual meals, it's tough to do. In fact, I have a good friend. He weighs probably 260, 270 pounds, a professor, still bodybuilds. And he can't get that much protein from food. He's like, hell, I'd be tired chewing food. So I have to get at least 1 or 2 shakes a day.
Yeah.
And it's just easy. I mean, the reason I love these RTDs is it's such an easy, convenient way to meet your protein needs. And, you don't think of it as like, God, I have to have a meal. It's like, no, it's not like eating boring chicken with broccoli or something. You know, you're just drinking, and these shakes taste good. So you're just drinking a shake. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you know, when we first met, we were all younger, and now we're all much more mature, right? So you know where this one's going. How do your protein recommendations, if they do, how do they change with age? And specifically, because you did mention sarcopenia earlier, the age-related loss of muscle mass around that 40-year mark, somewhere around there. But do your protein recommendations or philosophy change at all with aging athletes?
Well, you know what's interesting, and I'm sure you're aware of the data showing that you become less sensitive to protein with age. So one could argue that 1 gram per pound is even more important for the older athlete who might be over 50 or 60 or 70 than the younger athlete. So if anything, what I would recommend the older athlete is you definitely can't eat less than that. You can't eat less than 1 gram per pound. It is critically important for you to make sure you hit that as your baseline, as your minimum. Yeah, just like you said, to avoid, you know, sarcopenia. I mean, just, you know, as you know, the loss of lean mass with age, it's just a predictor of just not many good things. So, with age, I hate to say it, but, you know, age always wins. That's what's up.
Yeah,
it does. And for you young listeners who are like, no, I'm bulletproof, like that's not going to happen to me. Listen, it happens. You lose muscle mass.
I started exercising when I was, I think, 10 or 11. My uncle was, I loved the martial arts. Then he taught me karate and I got hooked onto training of some sort, age 10, 11. I'm now 61 years old. And so I've been training roughly 50 years of my life. And for me, as I get older, recovery is such an issue that I can't, I tell people, you know, I could train just as hard as when I was 28, but I don't recover the same the next day. And I'm not even sure I recover the same 2 days later. And I'm like, and the thing is, I remember how I recovered. That's what sucks. I remember.
And I'm like, want that again.
Yeah. I'm like, why am I not recovering like that? And then I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. I'm a lot older, but still it pisses me off.
I know. I'm right there with you.
Do you have troubles at all then? Or is this kind of your MO, like with gram of protein per pound of body weight? Or what is your average there if we were talking numbers these days?
Oh, I average, here's what's funny. It's funny. I did this calculation. I average in the last month, 0.95 grams per pound.
Oh my God.
Yes. And I'm someone who's aware of it. Here's the problem with my diet. I grew up eating a lot of rice because Asian families eat a lot of rice.
Yeah.
I'd rather eat rice than meat. And I know that it's like, okay, but I like rice. I like eating carbs. I mean, I love carbs. I don't know about you guys, but I love
carbs. Oh yeah. They're a you friend.
Know? Yeah. So I try to get extra protein through shakes. I have our refrigerator in a garage is basically, if you open it up, you're like, well, it's either a beer or a protein shake.
Actually,
you have a protein keg out there.
Yeah, I need that's to invent that.
But that's really, I think that's really empowering because, you know, the thing I get from a lot of athletes is because they ask me the same question. What does your diet look like? What do you do? And I'm like, listen, nobody's perfect. Like we all have these mountains to get over and certain times of the year or certain times of our life, it gets a little bit rough. So I think we're all in the same boat. We're just at different places in our path in this whole longevity and aging thing. Yeah. Like there may be, like you said, a month where, yeah, you know, I struggled this past month. And now we know like holidays, as we're recording, holidays are here. And I think a lot of people will struggle. I think, you know, but I think, I love what you said is that we all are kind of in this, right? And we're all trying to be aware, even the best of the best in protein research and real life, like we're still trying to do this the best we can, right? So nobody is perfect.
Yeah. And in fact, there are just some people who are so highly self-motivated and disciplined that it's not an issue. Like I was talking about, my wife averages 3 grams per kilo. I mean,
wow, that's amazing.
She
doesn't eat as much rice as you.
Definitely not. I wish I had her discipline when it comes to it. I mean, she knows grams of carbs, fat, and protein she consumes. It's like,
that's like, amazing. Yeah. Well, you that's amazing, really.
Okay, I got to know, Dr. Antonio, before we get to the ending segment of our discussion today, I know you take creatine, and you've taken that for a long time, and I guess we could call, you know, our protein powder another supplement in there, but are there any other supplements you take just for your own health and performance?
For my own health and performance, I've actually been taking baby aspirin for, I don't even know how long. I started that a long time ago. A lot of people don't call this supplement. I'm like, well, I take it every day. I take zeaxanthin and lutein for my eyes.
Okay.
I take glucosamine for my joints. Luckily, I still, you know what? A lot of my friends don't have all the real joints. I have so many friends. I have hip replacement, knee replacement. I'm like, God, I'm so glad I still have my joints. I don't have any replacements there. I take also it's a capsule, coenzyme Q10. I think in Japan, it's considered a drug, although here, you know, anyone can take it. And, but my go-to is creatine. I've been taking a little between 3 to 4 grams a day since Bill Clinton was president. Yeah.
I knew you were going to loop that president thing back in again. Has your dosage of creatine changed?
It's been very consistent. Yeah, because I take capsules. So, the capsules end up being, I think, like 3.4 grams, some weird number. So I'm like, I just take 3 capsules in the morning. Oh, and I also take magnesium daily. So that's my basic supplement schedule. You know, to me, the big ones are creatine, protein, caffeine. Protein, I get a lot of protein post-workout. I just drink shakes. Creatine every day, first thing in the morning. Caffeine, obviously that's with coffee. But if I have a race, I'll do a little bit of a higher dose of caffeine pre-race. But yeah, I mean, it's to me, there's so many things you can do to help whatever your goal is. But if you're not going to adhere to it and not be compliant, then it's, you know, hey, January 1 is coming up. I'm sure you have friends and family who are like, hey, could you tell me what I can do to lose weight? And
what my totally. Diet should
be? Yeah. I'm like, every damn year, I'm like, yeah. Wait a minute. You didn't do what I said last year.
I know.
And I'm like, wait, so you can't walk 3 times a week for 30 minutes. You can't do that. Yeah. But you want some complicated training program. No. Oh, and you want diet, which, by the way, diet is much harder than simple, easy exercise. You want me to give you a diet to lose weight? No, because you're just not going to follow. You might follow it for like 3 days and you're like, you know what? I don't like this diet. So yeah. it's just what weird that's, you know, I think people's expectations of what's supposed to happen, they don't realize the amount of work that's required to reach those goals. Because it's work. I mean, but you have to enjoy it. I think I enjoy the process of exercise. I've always loved it. I don't enjoy changing my diet at all. I do not enjoy that.
There's so much more habit and behavior change and forming in that versus an exercise, I find too. I mean, it is, unless you're like talking about training for some huge thing. I mean, then that's kind of a mountain to climb up. But no, I agree with you. It's like, whew. And that's what we hear a lot from our athletes is, man, it's going to take a while. And they don't realize that and how much energy and motivation and willpower and resources they need, right? I mean, they need us as resources, but it does definitely take a little bit longer than most people think. this is great, man. We have literally just touched the surface on this, but I think we've got some really good golden nuggets, I call them, for our listeners to be like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Like I can start doing that now. Like I can actually do that. And, you know, that's what we wanted to portray to our listeners is that, yeah, there's some, you've done, like you've pioneered, in my mind, at least, the protein research with athletes and sport nutrition, and really kind of have morphed that through your research, through ISSN. And one, I'm so appreciative too. We would love to invite you back on, you know, for part 13 million. I think we could definitely entertain that. But, you know, as we kind of transition into what we call our high five questions, these are questions that we want our listeners to get to know Joey a little bit more, right? Non-academic, non-science-wise. And these are just kind of, you know, finish up the chat. We're going to give each other a high five. So do you mind if I kind of launch into the first question here?
All right. Fire away.
So First question is, what's one of the best pieces of advice you've ever received?
One of the best pieces of advice I'd ever received. I think one, actually, I remember this is back in the early 90s. Clinton was president.
Yeah.
And it was this. It was the idea of, say, and this is when you're young and up and coming, so it doesn't apply if you're already established. Say yes to everything, figure out the details later. And that actually is how I lived from the 90s up until, you know, into the 2000s. Because when you're a young, up-and-coming person, you're trying to establish, you know, some sort of reputation. You want people to value what you have to say. You can't really be picky. And I tell students all the time, I'm like, if there's an opportunity there and it's like, I don't know if you can do it, just say yes.
Yeah.
Say yes. Figure out the details later, because that person may not ask you again. They may not ask you. They're going to ask someone else. So I always keep that advice to heart. It's like, you know what? I'll figure out the details later. But the answer is yes. And then after you say yes, you're like, holy shit, how am I going to do this?
Yeah.
Exactly. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I have a question here. Number two, what is one thing from your daily routine that you will not change from here on out? You just know it's not a compromise.
Okay. Well, daily. Okay. I was about to say exercise, but I train on average five days a week. So technically that's not daily. It's coffee in the morning. I am not getting rid of that at all.
Okay.
You will never do a study yourself that requires you not consuming coffee.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. In fact, you know, I always wonder about randomized controlled trials with coffee or caffeine. I'm like, what if you're randomized into the no caffeine group and you're a caffeine consumer?
I'm like, that would suck.
No, I'm not volunteering for that.
Yeah.
All right, Joey, number three, I'm not quite sure if you watch sports, but if you watch sports, what is a sport that you can just totally binge on watching?
Oh, well, there's three sports I watch a lot. Football, mixed martial arts, fights. I love the fight sports, and track and field. I can binge watch. It kind of depends who's fighting or who's playing in football or who's competing in track and field. But out of those three, I can probably binge watch mixed martial arts more than the other two.
Okay.
Actually, in our lab at Nova Southeastern University, we get a lot of professional UFC fighters come to our lab. We body comp them. My colleague, Corey Peacock, he trains a lot of these professional fighters. So a lot of fighters, as you may or may not know, a lot of them live in South Florida.
Yeah.
Because of the climate, they can train outdoors all year. Mm-hmm. And there's just a huge fight community down here. So I would say the mixed martial arts, I love that. And put it this way, this is how old I am. My dad, this is back when...
Which president?
Richard Nixon. Remember Richard Nixon?
Oh, yeah.
My dad was a huge fight fan. This is boxing because there was no MMA then.
Yeah.
He would take us, myself and my two brothers, we're little kids. Back then, okay, well, where do you watch fights? Well, I don't know if you remember something called closed circuit TV.
Mm-hmm.
A movie theater would rent it out. They would pay for rights to broadcast the fight. We would go literally into this movie theater. It'd be a bunch of middle-aged men and then three little boys, myself and my brothers. I remember watching Muhammad Ali fight Joe Frazier. I remember a lot of these, you know, these prize fights of guys that, you know, even George Foreman. That was my introduction to the fight sports. I'm like, wow, this is pretty cool. I like this stuff. So, yeah, we're talking about going back way back when I was a fan of the fight sports. I wasn't good at it, but I was a big fan.
Awesome. Okay, this is a quickie. Number four, what's your favorite whole food source of protein?
Favorite whole food?
So not powder or ready to drink.
Yeah,
which, you know, those are whole foods, but you know what I mean, like chewable. Yeah. Version.
Yeah. What's funny is I was about to say I love sashimi, but I would have to almost go by what I consume the most frequently. And that's actually steak. That is probably the whole food protein source that I consume the most frequently. Although, like, if I'm deathly hungry, choice between a steakhouse and a sushi house, I'd probably choose Japanese. Uh-huh. And it might be because I eat it less frequently. But in terms of frequency, I definitely eat steak more than I eat fish. And I love fish.
Okay.
Yeah. And you're in South Florida. So that says something, right?
Yeah, definitely. For sure.
All right, Joey, last question here. This one might be a little tricky. I don't think it will be tricky, but just because we've talked about so many things here, you know, supplements and protein involved, if you only had one piece of advice to give to athletes, what would that only one piece of advice be?
One piece of advice, and I'll pare it down to sports nutrition advice.
Yeah.
I'd say the one piece of advice I would give, and what's funny, this reminds me of talks I give to high school kids who run track and cross country because, you know, they have brains of mush and they don't pay attention to anything. Yeah. And they can't do anything you tell them. I say, just do one thing for me. Just do one thing. Consume a protein shake after you're done working out. That's it. Easy. You're done running. Your mom picks you up. Drink that shake in the car. It's simple. It's easy. There's a lot of delicious RTDs out there. That actually is the easiest piece of advice. If I say, you know, take 5 grams of creatine, they're like, I don't want to put powder and do this and swallow pills. I'm like, protein, post-workout protein shake. Simplest thing to suggest. And also compliance. It's relatively easy. People would comply with it. Because when you're done working out, it's like, well, what else am I going to do? I guess I could sit and wait. Well, no, sit, wait. Drink your shake. That's what
sit and sip.
Yep.
There we go. Perfect. Yep. Love it. You are such a gem, Dr. Antonio. We'll be sure to put links to your research, the ISSN, and much more in our show notes. And we definitely would love to have you back if you would accept a future invitation.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a fun convo. You guys are great. I mean, I looked at all the topics that we covered, a lot of it sort of in different order. Absolutely.
Thank you.
We are so appreciative of your time and expertise, and just love your storytelling too. It really kind of brings out a lot. So thank you so much from the bottom of our hearts.
Hey, you're welcome. Appreciate it.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you, listeners, for being here with us, and we will catch you on the next episode.
Thank you.
Thanks again for tuning in to this episode. We certainly enjoyed that conversation with Dr. Jose Antonio. Stay tuned for next week's episode. We are meeting with Mickey Willedon for a part two. She joined us in the summer of 2023 talking about lower carbohydrate, healthier fat, dietary patterns and weight loss. And so we're continuing the conversation, talking more on the LCHF realm. So stay tuned for that one coming your way next week. And remember, if you've got a sports nutrition question, you can drop us a note over at hello@insidesportsnutrition.com or on our website, insidesportsnutrition.com. You'll see a button there to submit your question. Always queuing those up for our Q&A and Ask Us Anything episodes. Don't forget to subscribe if you're not already, or follow along on your favorite podcast platform. Share with a friend, give us a 5-star rating, any kind of love like that definitely helps us continue to grow. Share our content with other listeners just like you around the world. If you'd like more info about the nutrition services, physiological testing services that Bob and I offer, or any of our other nutrition-geared programs, be sure to reach out to Bob over at energyperformance.com, energperformance.com, or myself, Dina, nutritionmechanic.com. Love to connect with you. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are solely those of the hosts and the guests involved and do not represent a replacement for medical consultation with your doctor. The information and opinions provided here are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease or medical condition. This podcast is for information, education, and entertainment purposes only.